Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Trump called for more troops in Afghanistan in a primetime televised address on Monday.
We are not nation building again. We are killing terrorists.
At a campaign rally in Phoenix on Tuesday, Trump supporters cheered as the president promised to build the border wall at all costs, even if it means shutting down the government. Hurricane Harvey is expected to bring life-threatening rainfall to Texas this weekend. Here's Corpus Christi Mayor Joe McComb.
We are going to, in the strongest possible terms, encourage the residents in the low-lying areas, as they say, get out of Dodge.
This hour on Point, it's our weekly news roundtable with Jennifer Epstein of Bloomberg News, Jonathan Landay of Reuters, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. What did you make of the president's speeches this week? Did he hit the right tone on Afghanistan, then go too far at the campaign rally? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington, Jennifer Epstein, White House reporter for Bloomberg News, traveling with the president this week. She was in Phoenix for the campaign rally. Jennifer, thanks for being with us again.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Also in Washington, Jonathan Landay, national security correspondent for Reuters. He's been writing about the president's Afghanistan strategy this week. Jonathan, welcome back to On Point.
Nice to be here.
And as always, from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty. Jack, always good to chat.
Hello, Bob, Jonathan, and Jennifer.
All right, let's talk about the speeches this week. Somber on Afghanistan, laying out war strategy, which we'll talk about specifically in a few minutes, but then almost mocking his own earlier remarks about the violence in Charlottesville at his rally in Phoenix. Jennifer, you were traveling with the president this week. How did his tone change?
Well, his tone changed extremely dramatically. He went from being at a military base in the D.C. area, speaking very somber terms, largely sticking to the teleprompter, speaking about sacrifice and also togetherness. And he really did, at the beginning of that Afghanistan speech on Monday night, make reference to Charlottesville without saying it, that, you know, that troops should return home to a peaceful and unified country. And then you saw something very different about 24 hours later. You saw this president angry as all get out about how the media has treated him and treated his response to Charlottesville. You just heard him over and over again talking about his grievances with the media, that we're unfair, that we're liars, that we hear what he says but we choose to mislead, and he got a little stronger than he usually does. He did when he attacks the media. You know, it's normal for him to say, you know, fake news, CNN, get a CNN sucks chant going at a rally. I've experienced that before at his events, but this time he said that journalists are maybe, you know, not patriotic.
Let's hear a little bit of that. Let's hear this soundbite of President Trump talking about the fake media in Phoenix on Tuesday.
They make up stories. They have no sources in many cases. They say a source says there is no such thing, but they don't report the facts. Just like they don't want to report that I spoke out forcefully against hatred, bigotry, and violence, and strongly condemned the neo-Nazis, the white supremacists, and the KKK.
Jennifer, what was it like to be in the media area during the rally? And do you sense that this now 6 or 8 month long since he's been in office war against the media is only going to ratchet up from this point on?
Well, I would note first that his tone against the media was much harsher than he's been at any point in time against neo-Nazis or white supremacists. So, you know, let's start at that point. he was really riling up the crowd in a way that a lot of people who covered him throughout the campaign have been at, you know, the vast majority of the rallies that he's done since 2015 have said it was very unusual, that he was much more forceful and that the crowd reacted by being much more boisterous and much more aggressive toward the media. There was no, you know, real, you know, threats, I would say, but there were a huge group of people, especially, I would say, you know, maybe 40 or 50 people standing right in front of where the traveling press was sitting. There was a low fence between us, but they seemed to be have chosen their place specifically so that they could taunt us from the other side of this low fence, that they seemed to want to keep an eye on us and, you know, consistently throughout the speech, you know, just tell us that we were liars, tell us that we suck, use words that I'm not going to use on the radio, you know, various finger gestures, and you know, just aggressive shouting. A couple of people who were just, you know, just had that angry, you know, that really like guttural, upset yell that I think is not just about the media, is about a whole lot more. But they and the president have helped channel it that way. There was a man right in front of me with an InfoWars T-shirt. You know, that's sort of the world that a lot of this is being stirred up in, that really nothing that the mainstream media does could ever be acceptable to them. You know, the closest is just, you know, Fox is great, which is something that the president, you know, repeated. And he said, especially that Sean Hannity, he's the best, isn't he? And that whole tone just seems to be getting more forceful. And I do think journalists who cover the president, who are usually not, you know, the ones who are in harm's way, you know, we're not doing something covering a war zone, covering, you know, any kind of, you know, the kind of places where journalists are generally actually in danger, do feel more concerned. I've definitely heard that from a couple of reporters since Tuesday, that they're worried that there will be some kind of incident that specifically targets somebody who's perceived to cover Trump or write about Trump or just be in the fake news. You know, different from, you know, there were obviously some little tiffs, or I don't want to say little, but some incidents that happened in Charlottesville, you know, where somebody was aggressive toward a journalist. But that was more about, you know, just I don't want to be covered kind of thing. I think that this, there's a real fear that there will be something more targeted. I've heard of people covering the logos on their bags or, you know, if they have a news organization logo. One person was telling me that yesterday. I think it's a time when the kind of journalists who, you know, live pretty mundane lives, you know, other than being in very close proximity to the president and members of Congress and the White House and all of that there is a little bit more of a personal concern than has typically been the case. Even, I think, in some ways, maybe even during the campaign when, yeah, you would get personal threats, but they weren't coming from the president of the United States riling up his base. He was a candidate. And he didn't seem to be getting more and more intense in those attacks as time went on.
Jonathan, the rant, the Rambo, decried by his critics but loved by his supporters. He served up the red meat for supporters in Phoenix, as Jennifer is telling us. Is he playing to the base, to the audience, or are we seeing more and more the real Donald Trump?
You know, there's an interesting debate that's going on now, and increasingly you see questions about the president's competence, his ability to be a president. Members of his own party have raised that question. He has now gone after Senator Bob Corker, in his latest attack on a member of his own party, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, comments by Senator Corker raising questions about the president's ability to lead the nation and his competence. The White House fired back very forcefully yesterday against those comments, and then
calling it ridiculous. They called it ridiculous.
Ridiculous and not worthy of a comment. And now we've seen the president go after Senator Corker. And it seems that as he gets further into this first year of his presidency and is not achieving some of the major goals that he had promised as a candidate last year, that the frustration level, his anger at Congress, whom he is blaming for all of this, has been rising. And we've seen that in the public rallies that he's had, nothing like we saw in Phoenix. And as this goes on, because it looks like September next month may bring even more gridlock in Congress as they get down to major debates over whether over raising the debt ceiling, something that has to be done according to the Treasury Department, or the United States begins defaulting on its loans or its debts. And the need for a spending measure to tide over the federal government so it can continue operating. All of that now complicated now by his comments about his willingness to shut down the government if he doesn't get money for to build the southern wall. It looks like we could see even more of this.
Jack, about a minute and a half before the break, let me ask you this. Let me come back to the Corker question. This morning in a tweet, Mr. Trump retaliated saying Tennessee is not happy with Mr. Corker. What's the likelihood that all this chatter about President Trump's stability and competence becomes serious?
Well, it is becoming serious. I mean, when you have Bob Corker talking about his stability in public, that's as serious as it gets. And this week has just seen, you know, example after example that you could, well, for example, in the middle of his speech in Phoenix, he says, "Now, you know, I was a good student. I always hear about the elite. You know, the elite, they're elite. I went to better schools. I got better grades." This is a kind of a Freudian delight, isn't it? I mean, what is this insecurity that he's just displaying? It was enough to make one commentator, the former DI director Clapper, wonder about, you know, his access to the nuclear codes.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the president's strategy in Afghanistan and U.S. troops abroad. We're going to get to that in a minute. You can join the conversation. Do you think the president's plan will bring an end to the war in Afghanistan? Should we be sending more troops? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Our guests are Jennifer Epstein, White House reporter for Bloomberg News, Jonathan Lande, national security correspondent for Reuters, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Let me come back to the president's speech this week. On Wednesday in Reno, the president spoke to veterans at the American Legion National Convention. He called for national unity at a time of political unrest, which was, as we know, a departure from his statements the previous night at the rally in Phoenix.
It is time to heal the wounds that divide us and to seek a new unity based on the common values that unite us. We are one people, with one home and one great flag.
Jack Beatty, what do we make of the president's different styles this week? The New Yorker points out he read excerpts from remarks that he made about the Unite the Right gathering in Charlottesville, Virginia, and the violence it sparked. And he said, you know, my own words are perfect. What is it about the politics of division that appeal to this president?
Well, it's how he was elected. I mean, by running on division, and stirring up tensions. But on the other hand, he's in a permanent campaign. I think the day he was inaugurated, he filed papers to run again in 2020. And his strategy to run again seems to be to win with 33% of the vote. How you do that is a miracle. But he's done nothing to play the usual political game, which isn't subtraction but addition, adding people. He's done nothing to add anybody. So he's desperate to hold on to that cadre. Therefore, he gives speeches full of red meat and full of the build the wall and even a few apparently cries of lock her up to references to Hillary, the old standbys. But on the same time, he's also president, and he has to do these ceremonial occasions, and he has to say these ritualized, the kind of thing the presidents are supposed, high-minded sentiments presidents are supposed to deliver. But it never feels like his own tongue. It's someone else's words. His convictions aren't there. And it's in tension with this permanent campaign he's running.
All right, let's talk about the war in Afghanistan. In a nationally televised address on Monday, the president suggested further and stronger military action in Afghanistan, but then did not specify the number of additional U.S. troops who might be sent to the country.
Our troops will fight to win. We will fight to win. From now on, victory will have a clear definition. Attacking our enemies, obliterating ISIS, crushing al-Qaeda, preventing the Taliban from taking over Afghanistan, and stopping mass terror attacks against America before they emerge.
Jonathan Landay, what do you see in the president's strategy here?
Not a lot. It was bereft of many details. It appears that it is a continuation to a great extent of his predecessor's strategy, Mr. Obama's, with a couple of twists. He's already given, before this speech, the authority to his military commanders to increase the number of troops, but only by, it looks like, only around about 4,000. So in the end, you may have about 12,000 American troops. How 12,000 American troops are going to defeat the Taliban when 100,000 couldn't under President Obama is a major question. President Trump also appeared to de-emphasize the use of diplomacy, something that even senior military commanders say is the only way out of this war, this 16-year-old war, by saying someday perhaps we can look for a political solution. And so that is a difference with President Obama, who put a great deal of emphasis on trying to bring the Taliban to the negotiating table. At the same time, both strategies appear to be intended to fight the Taliban to a stalemate and then leave them no choice but to bring them to the table.
Well, what are the chances that would work?
I don't think it will. Not. It didn't work with 100,000 foreign troops, and I don't think it's going to work with 12,000 foreign troops pursuing this. And not only that, but under President Obama, there was direct combat between American formed troops and the insurgents. As I understand it, under his strategy, American advisors will be able to embed at a lower level with Afghan units, than they are now, but not in direct combat. Now, there also seems to be an increased emphasis in the use of air power. The American Air Force has, in fact, there's been a surge already in the use of American air power against the Taliban. But that raises another question, and that is the question of civilian casualties, which is a very, very delicate and emotional question in Afghanistan. I've spent years covering Afghanistan, and was there when there was a tactical directive that was issued by the American commander at the time to the troops to avoid civilian casualties because of the political blowback that it was creating. So if you have a situation here where the leash is being taken off the American Air Force, which appears to be doing, and it appears that you're going to have more special forces operation. That also raises a question about whether or not we're going to see an even higher increase in civilian casualties, which I believe, according to the United Nations, are already at their highest level.
All right, let's bring an on-point listener to this conversation at this point. Pam is calling from Cass Town, Ohio. Hi, Pam. Go ahead.
Hi, Bob. I agree with the increase in troops. And I'm listening about the when we had 100,000 troops there. Yes, during that time, my son was there, and I've had nephews also serve in Iraq and Afghanistan. But during that 100,000, I'm just thinking back, they were building schools, building roads, repairing bridges, building forward out bases, clearing bombs. There was a lot of things that were being done at that time to nation build. What Trump is saying, I'm not doing that. I'm there to remove terrorists. And I agree with, you know, the air attacks, less men on the ground. But I also approve of how he handled, you know, ISIS. Sounds like we've been pretty aggressive, and it's worked. We do not need to tell the world what day we're going to attack. That number, 4,000, was that a real number or was that a guesstimate? Because I don't think he's going to tell you exactly how many he's putting out there, and I admire that.
Just so I'm clear, Pam, are you saying that 3,000 or 4,000 more troops in Afghanistan, or even if it's 12,000 more troops, are not enough, that we should go back to the level of troops that you mentioned, maybe 100,000, so that we can engage in nation building?
No, I was referencing the 100,000 that we had before and what they were doing then, versus less boots on the ground, maybe more military, you know, action from the air. And, you know, I don't have the answers, but I have to throw this in here. The first guest was a journalist who she was offended. But if what does the poll say about our trust in the media? It was at 30%. Why is that? That's because when I look at the news, I see opinion, not fact. I'm sorry. Did I get hung up on?
Okay, Pam, I think we got it. Thank you very much. Let's go to another on-point caller right now. Steven is on the line from Syracuse, New York. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hello. How you doing, Tom?
Good. Go ahead.
This is Bob, not Tom. Sorry. The last caller you had, they shouldn't stick their nose in business. They don't know what they're talking about. We've obviously gone through this for 12, 13, 14 years, and we've gotten nowhere except for our troops getting killed. And you cannot fix the Middle East. There's no fixing. And what he's doing is sending more troops over there, is just risking the lives of our troops. And it's not doing anything for ISIS to come over here and commit crimes and kill people.
So you have no faith then in the president's new Afghan war strategy laid out this week?
I have no faith in the president. And if it wasn't for the news and the media putting out all this stuff, it's based on fact. The caller you just had before said it was just opinion. It's not opinion. These people do their job. You do your job. You look into these things on a consistent basis. And things he's doing are just, you're dividing America more than it's ever been divided. And that's what President Trump wants. He's still got Steve Bannon's voice in his ear. He wants to tear it down, burn it up, and start all over again.
All right, Stephen, thank you very much. And let's take one more on-point caller before we come back to our guest. Jim is on the line from Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Hi, Jim.
Hey, guys. You know, I have to agree with the caller before this last one. Go ask ISIS whether Obama kicked their tails or Trump has kicked their tails. The gloves are off. That's why we are winning. That's why Syria is in a ceasefire. And I've got the answer to why 65 million Trump voters think that you're fake news is because you colluded with the Democrat Party, and we know that through WikiLeaks. You guys are all fake. Every single one of you, Bloomberg, Reuters, every one of you guys are fake news, and we all see it, and we all laugh. That's why That's why Trump won, and that's why we're going to blow away 2018, and 2020 is going to be a bloodbath for the Democrats. You guys are propaganda arms for the Democrat Party, and we all see it.
Okay, thanks very much. I have to say I never thought of myself that way, not ever in a 40-year career. Let's talk about whether the generals have influence here. Yesterday, General John Nicholson, the top commander of NATO and U.S. troops in Afghanistan, defended the president's Afghan strategy. Here he is.
This new policy is different. It's conditions-based, not time-based, and our end state is a peaceful reconciliation. That means there will be no terrorist attacks emanating from this region against the Afghan people or against the United States and its allies.
Jonathan, is the president listening to his generals?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, that's what's going on here, because during the Obama administration, there was considerable management, what military officers would call micromanagement, all the way from the White House when it came to military operations, even individual air operations. Those reins have been taken off the military. As General Nicholson just said, they now have an open-ended, essentially what this is an open-ended operation. There's no time limit on it. And when he says conditions-based, as he defined it as basically being a peaceful Afghanistan with no terrorist attacks. Again, if you can't do that with 100,000 troops, and let me correct the record here. I spent years since 1986 going to Afghanistan, embedding. I was there when the Soviets were there. I was there when the Americans went in. I've been embedded with the troops. They have not, to a great extent, they were not, to a great extent, emphasizing nation building. There was billions and billions of dollars poured in to, quote-unquote, nation build, but a lot of that was undertaken by international contractors, not by American forces. American forces were deeply involved in fighting the Taliban. I was with them. I know what went on. And the idea that you can embed American advisors down to basically, I believe it's the brigade level now under these new rules, and be able to succeed in bringing peace to Afghanistan, I just don't see it. Now, the other aspect of the president's policy, which we haven't talked about, is getting tougher with Pakistan, where the Taliban and other groups, the Haqqani Network, which is allied with the Taliban, have sanctuary and allegedly have been supported by elements of the Pakistani military and intelligence agency known as the ISI. He talks about getting tougher on them, but we don't have any details on how much tougher and what exactly he intends to do to force Pakistan, as he said, immediately to stop providing harbor for these extremist groups. That we just don't understand. The Obama administration used financial incentives to try and get the Pakistanis to change their policy. The Pakistanis, however, have said, the military has said, that they will continue to seek their national priorities in and those include a friendly government in Kabul to Pakistan, and one that resists the influence of India, Pakistan's main rival. So at this point, it just does not appear. We don't have the details on how the president and his military commanders intend to reverse the situation in Afghanistan, bring the Taliban to the negotiating table, and get a political settlement that brings peace to this country.
And do you see and no timetable for when U.S. troops might get out of Afghanistan, no timetable for an end to all this?
That's right. I mean, it's open-ended. They are going from what they call a time-based operation to one of conditions-based, i.e., conditions that are bringing peace to Afghanistan, as General Nicholson, you just heard him say, bringing peace to Afghanistan with no terrorist attacks. Well, you know, that could, if we couldn't do it in the last 16 years, it's hard to see how an open-ended American involvement there is going to be any more successful.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, the country was captivated by the first total solar eclipse to cross the continental United States since last century. Two children in Menan, Idaho, react. And then it was jackpot. Mavis Wanzek won the largest single prize in U.S. lottery history yesterday with almost $759 million in a Powerball jackpot. Here's what she told her employer of 32 years, Mercy Medical, in Western Massachusetts after she won.
I've called them and told them I will not be coming back.
And a new persona for Taylor Swift. Taylor released her first solo single in 3 years overnight. Here's Look at What Made Me Do It.
I'm sorry, the old Taylor can't come to the phone right now. Why? Oh, because she's dead.
The song is actually Look at What... Look at what you made me do. Sorry, Taylor. You enjoying the conversation. Do you support rolling back national monument designations? Are you watching what might happen at the upcoming white nationalist rallies this coming weekend? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Our guests are Jennifer Epstein, White House reporter for Bloomberg News, Jonathan Landay, national security correspondent for Reuters, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Jennifer, during his campaign rally in Phoenix on Tuesday, the president threatened to shut down the U.S. government if Congress refuses to fund construction of the border wall between the U.S. and Mexico. Here's what he said.
Build that wall. Now, the obstructionist Democrats would like us not to do it, but believe me, if we have to close down our government, we're building that wall. Let me be very clear to Democrats in Congress who oppose a border wall and stand in the way of border security. You are putting all of America's safety at risk. You're doing that.
Jennifer, how likely is it that the president's going to get his way and get the money for the wall?
It seems like it is a possibility. You do have a lot of House Republicans who are on board with this. But you also have House Speaker Paul Ryan, who leads that team, saying that there won't be a government shutdown over the wall or anything else. The White House has kind of spun that as meaning that that he will push for that funding and make it happen. But I think that the top priority coming from Hill leadership is to avoid a government shutdown, avoid not raising, make sure that the debt ceiling is raised by the end of September. Those are the priorities on the Hill, are to do those things. And the president, is setting up, more of a political game than anything else, where he's saying, I am willing to go to this extreme length. So either the Hill should put up or shut up. And it's not the kind of situation that you typically see a president putting his own party, when his own party leads both chambers of Congress, in ahead of this next 5 or 6 weeks of intense negotiations that we can expect.
So if he doesn't get his way, though, do you think that President Trump will try to follow through on shutting down the government? Is that even possible?
Ultimately, that's up to lawmakers. That's why there are three co-equal branches of government. He doesn't get to make that kind of decision. He gets to make a lot of other decisions. But when it comes to the purse strings, Congress plays quite a role. I guess he could veto whatever bills get to his desk, but then he becomes, puts himself in an even more dangerous position and could also face an override then, because you do have this huge tension between the Hill and the White House, including Republicans. And maybe the same way that it happened with the Russia sanctions bill, you ultimately see lawmakers trying to tell Trump, there are certain lines we won't cross, or certain things that we demand happen, and that seems like it could be a possibility. But right now, you know, we're still very early in this process. He has meetings scheduled with the Democratic and Republican leaders of Congress once they get back from recess in a little bit. And I think that then we'll see this process begin in earnest. For right now, it's a lot of grandstanding, either on Twitter, at this rally. You know, next week he's going to be talking about tax reform, even though the White House isn't putting out its own plan separate from the Hill. You know, they're trying to push a lot of different things. He's not letting go of, you know, finding a way to repeal and possibly replace the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
There's a whole lot on this president's, on the Hill's agenda right now. The things that are most essential right now are funding the government and raising the debt ceiling. The president's adding all these other dimensions into it because he's impatient. He's upset that nothing big has been accomplished. That's why you see, you know, the tweet like he did this morning, or something that he referenced at the rally earlier this week, which is, you know, that he signed more bills than anyone because he signed a lot of small bills, these Congressional Review Act bills that have rolled back regulations, things like that. But the point remains that he has not signed into law any of his big priorities, any of the things that were his campaign promises, and that's why you're seeing him lash out at the Hill as he has, and you know, targeting specific lawmakers and you know, the caucuses as a whole.
Jack Beatty, does a frustrated President Trump have the spine for vetoing a debt ceiling plan if it doesn't include money for the border wall, do you think?
Oh, I think that his economic people would riot. You know, Secretary Mnuchin and Gary Cohn, his economic advisor, I could imagine they would even resign over that. They are, you know, they're after all Goldman Sachs alumni, and they understand as well as anyone that how imperative that is and what it would mean to essentially befoul U.S. credit forever. No, that can't happen. I just don't believe it can. And you know, you can notice that there was tension between Secretary Mnuchin and Nick Mulvaney, the White House budget director, who a couple of weeks ago came out and said, "Well, we don't need a clean debt ceiling raise. That is just that measure. We need to attach things to it. You know, the House Republican agenda and so on." And Mnuchin immediately said, "No, we need a clean bill, so there's something that can pass." And I think subsequently Mulvaney has come on board and said, "All right, we need a clean bill." So for a while, even the White House seemed to be talking against the possibility of a clean bill, but now I think the danger of that has concentrated minds.
Jody's on the line calling from Smithville, Tennessee, wanting to talk about the border wall. Jody, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to say that not every Mexican or Spanish person or foreigner that comes across our border is a criminal. I would like to commend all the people who sheltered Jose Gutierrez, one of the first soldiers to die fighting for our freedom in Iraq. You can read his story on the Military Times, The Fallen, a young soldier. You need to read his bios. Also, at the same time, they come here to fill jobs that most of us don't want to do, like slaughtering animals, milking cows, meat packaging, picking fruits and berries. They're demeaning jobs that most of us as Americans would take for granted someone else will do them. Well, they do.
So Jody, you think the border wall is a waste of time and money?
I do. Maybe we just need quotas so that they won't die in the desert trying to get here to take a job that's already filled. The wall, they'll always find a way. If you read Jose Gutierrez's story, I can't say his name correctly. I apologize. He deserves better credit than what he's receiving. They come here honorably with good motives, but they die. And maybe they wouldn't if they did. There was a quota where we say there's no jobs available. It's a waste of time. You'll die trying to survive here.
All right, Jody, thank you very much. We appreciate the comments. Zachy is on the line now from Nashville, Tennessee. Go ahead, Zachy.
Thank you, sir, for allowing me. First, allow me to say that I really enjoy your show. I discovered your show about a month ago. And you don't need me to validate your show, but please do not listen to the gentleman who called. He's misguided. I enjoy your show, and I think you're a very impartial person.
Well, thank you very much. I think you're talking about Tom Ashbrook, the host of this program. I'm just filling in today. Talk to us about the border wall.
Yeah, let me talk about the border wall. As an immigrant, actually, who was in this country for 29 years, every time that a new administration come up with the method that they think it'll work, people will always jump on. I mean, I think the border wall is a terrible idea. Whenever you build an infrastructure that will actually keep people out, people are creative. They will find a way to come to get around it. My thing is, why don't we do the same thing that every civilized country does? Why don't you just, I mean, when I was taking citizenship, I was given a test, which I don't think a majority of Americans will not pass. What I'm saying is that we give a test when you want to get a job. You have to be able to have a resume. You have to be able to have some sort of a qualification by which you will be let in to have that job. Why are we questioning whenever someone says that? If you want to come into the United States, what we need you to have is we need you to have at least the basic understanding of the language, the system, and you have to have a way that you will be able to contribute to society, like having some sort of a degree. And then other people who do not have that background, we should consider and give them actually some sort of humanitarian. But let's not shoot it down whenever somebody says that we should prioritize, because every other country, civilized countries like Canada, New Zealand, Australia, England, even Saudi Arabia, they're doing the same thing. Why are we just saying that let's just keep all the gate open and let everybody else come in? When you do that, you will no longer have what is called middle class. I thank you for giving me the opportunity, sir.
Zaki, you're very welcome. Thank you very much for calling, and call again. Jack Beatty, how does President Trump sell this new border wall plan to his base, that instead of Mexico, after pledging endlessly that Mexico would pay for the wall, now he says he's willing to shut the government down in order to get U.S. taxpayers to pay for it? How does he sell that to the base?
At a certain point, the base seems to be immune to logical contradiction. That is, their connection to him is quite apart from the truthfulness or consistency of anything he says. This week, the Washington Post fact checker said that since being president, he has told about 1,000, or he's made, you could let's be polite, 1,000 misrepresentations, told, in other words, about 1,000 lies, a rate of about 4 point something a day. That doesn't seem to have hurt him among his base. They seem to see that he's in touch with some higher truth that's beyond the law of contradiction, that's beyond refutation by fact, and that truth seems to be an expressive one. He's, so long as he's out there giving vent to their grievances about status and about the position of workers left behind and so on, that seems to be enough. So I don't see that as a problem, that inconsistency as a problem at all with his base.
And do you think that he can bully Congress into doing what he wants, get the money for the wall?
No. No. He tried to do something like that with, on the health care bill. It backfired on him. And he simply has to understand that this is a co-equal branch of the government. And this week's feud, that didn't happen this week, but it was exposed this week with Mitch McConnell, is a damaging, self-hurtful, self-destructive move by the president. He needs Mitch McConnell to get his program through. And without Mitch McConnell, he wouldn't have his major achievement, which is the appointment of Judge Gorsuch. That wouldn't have happened but for Mitch McConnell having stymied President Obama's nomination for the court and Merrick Garland for a year. So he owes that, his major achievement, to this one man, and he spends a week defaming him. It just doesn't make sense.
Well, McConnell wasn't the president's only target this week. At his campaign rally in Phoenix, the president took a dig at Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona for the health care bill failure. He also went after Arizona's GOP Senator Jeff Flake, who's up for re-election in 2018.
One vote away, I will not mention any names. Very presidential, isn't it? Very presidential.
And nobody wants me to talk about your other senator, who's weak on borders, weak on crime. So I won't talk about him.
He was talking about Jeff Flake. And then on Thursday, in an interview on Fox and Friends, Flake downplayed the attacks the president has been waging against him.
I just have to concern myself with my own campaign and my day job of being a senator. So what the president does, or you know, that's his prerogative.
Jonathan, what do you think the president's end game is here?
Maybe to quote-unquote primary senators of his party who he perceives as not being quote-unquote loyal and supporting his agenda 100%. The president has effectively endorsed a former state senator in Arizona, Kelly Ward, who is running against Jeff Flake in the GOP primary. And he's also gone after Dean Heller of Nevada, perhaps to try and it's a threat to primary him. And that may even be what he was aiming at Bob Corker about, where he says, where he talks about Tennessee. It's not a good deal for Tennessee. And that may very well be where he thinks he can go.
Jonathan, you had the last word. Thank you very much. Jonathan Linde, national security correspondent for Reuters. Great to have you again. Thanks.
My pleasure.
Thanks to Jennifer Epstein, White House reporter for Bloomberg News, for being with us today. Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you.
And as always, Jack Beatty, you're great. Thanks.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up on Monday, the world's top central bankers meet in Wyoming. Worries about low inflation and keeping economic growth on track on the agenda. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.